Deux, trois, boom.
Hugh Hendry, the acid capitalist, seeking therapy in life, seeking direction, seeking remedies, and coming the central park of Wall Street, the central park. Should I be saying, give me a train station, Penn Street Station. I am pending. I am with the remarkable Denise Shull, and I'm all yours, but you know me, who you are. Tell the folk. Who the folk lay it down, miss?
You know, beyond, I'm Denise Shull, and I like, you know, figure out what's going on in people's brains and lives and hopefully help them get better at whatever's going on.
Okay. Denise, may I ask that you begin today's session of therapy?
So what's on your mind? What's been happening since we spoke last?
What a question. I thought you were gaining a deeper understanding of me. And yet that question is very revealing, because I think it'd be better said, what's not on my mind? I mean, everything's on my mind, my monkey mind. However, since we last spoke, I completed, I had a milestone, not a kidney stone, milestone, the house. Yeah, I completed the house. And anyone that had been following me on my Instagram stories, I think, would have seen the escalating tension. We were working to a very tight deadline. We had clients incoming. And in fact, I had to send the clients on the day of arrival to a wonderful five-star hotel, pending unit, if you will, as we clambered to complete this wonderful villa, which we've now called the Sun Club. And then that evening, these wonderful clients insisted that I join them in the villa. The lack of demarcation is a strange one. And I have that in all walks of life. You know, I feel like my life is the Truman Show. These podcasts certainly would alleviate, not alleviate, they certainly accentuate the symptoms of being deranged. But here I was, that the house is very much part of my physical portfolio, and it's meant to be detached. It's for the use of the clients. And there I am, being the DJ, of course, and drinking the tequila and spending the night in the salt shed. And then the next morning, boom, I left. And I haven't been back on the island for about 6 weeks. I've been.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I usually don't ask someone directly how they feel, but what feelings do you have about that house?
I'm hoping, foolishly, that house has become a little bit similar to when I began my hedge fund career. And I was constantly displaced, or perhaps avoiding, in the pursuit of who I am. Am I any good? Yeah. And I wrapped the answer, I wrapped my identity around something very foolish, which was this letter postdated to me in the future, or several letters spaced out between 5 years. So 5 year, 10 year, 15 years. And in that letter contained just one number, and it would be the compound annual growth rate in the net returns to the clients of the hedge fund. I want to say foolishly, I can say that after the event, I thought in opening it up, it would reveal who I am. And of course, I'm sure you're going to tell me that we are manifold personalities, and certainly are way greater and more complex than one single number. And so it perhaps points itself to perhaps the insecurity of creativity. But with this,
you wrote yourself letters?
No, I wish.
Is that literal?
So it would be a letter written to me by the fund administrators, which would be telling me the compound growth rate in the fund's return. So,
but you didn't actually do that.
Oh, like everything, I'm being poetic.
Metaphor, okay.
Exaggerating with metaphors.
Well, so poetic, I thought it was possible.
Well, maybe I should start doing that. I've certainly read about folks doing that. But I completed the first Maison Blanc Bleu in St. Bart's at the end of the calendar year 2015. And it's been just a remarkable success. And it moves people. People really have an affinity with it. And it was a pivot. You know, the proclamation to the creative is pivot. Don't just remain in a single channel. And so I found that I was able to lend my imagination to architectural and design features, which came to the fore with this house. And so the question with the second was, you know, anyone can be lucky, but once
you
start,
do it again.
Yeah, multiple observation points, and of course being analytical. alongside creative, the analytical sucker, you know, the 5-year compound growth rate, the 10-year growth rate, the second house, the third house would perhaps reveal, but perhaps that in itself just reveals an insecurity to accept who I am. So you tell me.
Well, what I want to know is, like, you finished it and someone visited and you haven't been back. That's super interesting. Like, I know you had a birthday and, like, you've had places to be, but that's kind of curious. Like, it would seem like you would want to be there seeing it.
Well, not only that, but, you know, we began this series of investigations, this diving deep into the murky mind of myself with this revelation that my life was in flux, that I found myself divorcing from a lifetime partner. Mm-hmm. And that's progressing. And I've gone from peak agony and confusion, and I've come to understand the kind of teachings of the Buddha. I've come to free myself from the slavery of a belief in permanent outcomes. So I want to say I'm wiser. I think I'm becoming happier. But at the same time, coincident with that has been a desire to reach an amicable agreement. And it would seem that just as the house was completing, I'm finding myself edging towards a solution where my better half, if you will, actually will receive that second house as a settlement, as full and final settlement. And so not only had I finished it, and of course, in my mind, it would never be finished. There's tweaking and, you know, this the endless pursuit mm-hmm. of perfection. But perhaps that lends itself to why I haven't been back. It's a very strange. Mm. I feel like I've just given birth to something from my imagination, and now I've put it out to adoption. So it does feel challenging.
I can see that. Like, I mean, on one hand, I hate to question that, but I am curious, like, what your rationale for that was.
In terms of the settlement, the offering of the house.
Yeah, yeah.
It does
seem like giving away a childhood. I mean, I'm in the process of designing a house. And so I, you know, it already feels, I think, like a baby.
For sure.
I mean, that's a tricky one for me to question, but it's interesting to me. Maybe for now it's best left to that, but
I mean, there was very little leeway. There was very little, hey, what if we do this and we do that? There are outcomes which are somewhat inevitable. And and it's still, I mean, I hope I'm not jumping the gun. You know, these things are, one has to tread carefully, but that seems to be the general direction in which I'm heading. And so I've been discombobulated. I've added to that with this. You know, since then, I came to Los Angeles. I went to St. Louis to the wonderful, now forgive me, is it the University of Washington or the Washington University of St. Louis? There are so many of these damn things, albeit one can say one of the top, most magnificent.
I think that's Washington University.
And so I spent 2 days there. And then
doing?
Well, I was very kindly invited by the finance faculty. They have a master's degree. And it actually specifically focuses on those wishing to pursue a career in hedge funds. It's interesting. Mm. Everyone begins with the notion that they all want to be the chief investment officer. And part of the course, of course, is the enrichment of knowledge. And so it brings to the fore the multi-disciplines which are necessary to run these organizations. And the critical, the key person roles of the chief information officer, you know, the compliance, the marketing. The executive function.
Which trips everybody up.
Well, yeah, but in doing so also, it kind of reveals that the most precarious role is actually the one of the investment officer. And the one that's more of a passport and which is more portable would be any of the other, especially if you're capable of, you know, an accepted level of performance. And so at the end of the course, they find when they do the poll, they find that the answers are more evenly spread across the key functions of hedge funds. But anyway, I was
like, that's what people want to be.
Yeah, indeed. Aspirational. But I laid an instruction manual, a video which will go on and form the bedrock of the next 3 years of student material in that course. And then I was very kindly invited to actually address the students, which was fun.
Wow. So that actually leads me to the flip question, which is, what's next?
Yeah, that becomes more and more relevant. What is next? And that's,
what do you know?
I don't. I believe I mentioned it the last time. I have an aspiration to try and actually commercialize my social engagement. And we'll see with that. But then wise ahead say to me, you know what, selling acid capitalist hats, you got to, even at the preposterous $100 that I insist on selling my hats. And please, people, if you're watching, acidcap.com, be preposterous, make bold statements. Believe me, when I walk down the streets, people stop me. When I go into aircraft, people stop and they compliment and they want to know the story of acid capitalism. You could be.
It's a catch.
It is, yeah. I have to commit actually sometime next week to the manifesto. I've got to put 3 pages down on terms of what it represents, apart from just being a catchy name.
Says who?
Says my book agent, again. The steps that we make with regard to commercialization. And anyone watching this would be going, oh my God, are we talking about the book again? You know, a book or some version of the book has been written now for the last 2 years. It was written 2 years ago, and I'm still trying to get it out there.
They're tricky projects.
It's a tricky project.
I just turned down an offer and yeah, reworking it. They're tricky projects. What kind of mood are you in?
I've got to get back to St. Bart's.
I'm surprised you could stay away this long.
Well, I have to, actually. It's a part of life reengineering. It's glorious and wonderful. But first of all, it's a fantasy island. So, you know, red flag. There's a degree of I have to kind of hide and seek shelter there. I could be drinking every day and entertaining the many wonderful people who come on vacation. But that's not a life I would choose. Yeah. And it's preposterously small, and therefore one has to kind of, I have to be in, I'm going to say sensible, real places, and then you're going to come back and say, West Hollywood?
Well, I sort of get the relative, sensitive, real, easily St. Bart.
So there's that. I
have a little of that living in Park City, but.
Talking of which, I believe I had a DMT experience without the DMT.
And? Tell us.
It was remarkable. And it was a remarkable assault on my rational mind.
Oh, good.
And I'm
now we're getting somewhere.
Yeah. Have I been boring you?
You could never be boring, but you know, that made me want to ask you, which I don't think I have, is do you dream and do you remember your dreams ever? You know. But we can do the first one. We can do your subject first.
At that point, I think I do a lot of daytime dreaming, and I certainly am subject to panic. I put a little kind of short out last week, just coinciding with the riots in Paris. I find myself in Paris, panic in the streets of London, panic in the streets of Paris. And I certainly do have moments where I feel kind of overwhelmed. Again, I don't know if I invite these moments on, but it made me, I have a curious mind. It made me curious to pursue things. I met some wonderfully creative, one-of-a-kind people in West Hollywood, the real deal, one of whom very kindly recommended the services of, well, let's be preposterous, but, you know, a healer. And there's a funny thing in that, you meet someone and you're getting along, but they're very convinced that you're in need of healing. And wow. It's like, have you got
they
something?
They're talking their book.
Oh, no, this isn't the healer. This is the friend. And it's like, you know, lady, we just met and you're sending me to get healed. I mean, this is something I should know. So, you know, I find that amusing.
Well, people always tell you to do the thing that they would do.
Yeah, join my club.
It's amazing how if you ask for advice, the advice you get will be the thing the person would do. They don't think about you and your circumstances generally, but in any event, the DMT, so, DMT experience, non-experience, what was that?
Okay, so
we got to figure out like where you are actually. Now I'm curious about the Buddha meditation breath work.
Mm. So it all comes together with this. So I met to keep the Smiths reference, a most charming man, and the intervention was remarkably modest. It's funny, actually, he challenged me initially by saying, you know, so how much are you worth? And that fried my mind. These are not questions I would entertain. He had no interest in my net worth. It was more the challenge. And I guess it was more his ability to observe my discomfort, if you will.
It's a very provocative question.
Yeah. And of course, with all of these alternatives, I'm very aware that, I mean, I go very open, and therefore I'm offering big revelations as to who I am already. Because I'm like, right. You know, listen, I'm not here to fight it. I'm here to learn. I'm here for an experience. So let's just cut to the chase. You know, Hugh Hendry, as a capitalist, same boss, getting divorced, living my life in a Benjamin Button state, which is to say in reverse, let's discuss. And the intervention was modest. And I really can't emphasize enough the word modest in terms of breathing. I think we're all familiar now with practitioners such as Wim Hof, the Dutchman who seems to be able to endure great extremes of cold and endurance. And I was asked to breathe with my mouth in and out of the mouth, but no more than five times. And then on the final occasion, I was sitting on a chair and I was probably kind of pushed back a little bit. And I was holding the breath and my neck was tapped. And that's all. And then there was there chanting? Were there incantations? You know, maybe, but I went into it very familiar with, you know, the tragedy of the late 1960s, where we were making great gains as a society in the treatment of mental distress using hallucinogenic drugs, right, and how that was actually abolished. It was outlawed by the federal government. And I was familiar with a body of work which had sought to use breathing techniques to overwhelm. I'm guessing you're overwhelming. Is it, what do you call it? The prefrontal cortex?
Maybe. I mean, yes, there is a part of your brain that many people will refer to as the prefrontal cortex. I think the latest neuroscience is that really those sections of the brain aren't all that significant relatively, that we're always using all parts of our brain. I mean, they've showed that children who literally have only brain stems, so you would think they're, you know, vegetable-like, have a lot of emotion. Like, how could that be? Because it's supposed to be in a higher order of the brain. But the science isn't really all that far along on, like, which part of the brain really does what, despite all the research you will see saying it. Except to say that we're mostly using all of our brain all of the time. It'd be interesting to see yours in an MRI machine, because it's about the connections and how people have different connections between different parts and different pathways that light up with different types of subject matters. But, you know, I don't know if I've told you this, that the real thing, the core, the cornerstone now of human perception and judgment is predicting a future feeling. You're always predicting a future feeling. And at its core, it's safe or not safe, but then it gets more nuanced than safe or not safe. And what are all the symbols in our world for safe or not safe? Actual capital, social reputation.
I'm always anticipating the worst.
Yeah. Well, you were trained for that, for one. Oh, by the way, our expectations are primarily based on our past experience, and our first 10, 15 years of life is the most, you know, in the weighted average of past experience, most heavily weighted.
Well, that has resonance. So I had a previous experience, which was very much to that. And so, yeah, which was very much to aggressive breathing intervention. And it was, there's a whole industry growing up around this. You know,
yeah.
It's like the emergence of yoga, commercialized yoga for members of the community, you know, to make a modest income. And they're switching now to breathing.
Andrew Huberman, Stanford, who, you know, he's not the be all and end all, but he has a really great podcast about all of these physical modalities. And now he's quoting a study that's saying 5 minutes of good breath work, to be defined, is more effective than meditation.
I heard that. And I've been adding that to my meditation. I'm doing 10 minutes of meditation, 5 minutes of breath work.
And then there's that book that came out like 3 years ago called Breath, by James Nestor, and he shows how it affects all parts of your body and you can affect disease and these crazy things where people breathing different have cured serious disease. But
well, I previously consulted via Zoom with a chap in Brazil, and that was, it was expensive. It was $1,500. And I thought,
per session, I guess, per hour.
Maybe it's just the Scottishness in me, you know, my short arms and my deep pockets, as they say. And I remember I was thinking of canceling it. And I was talking to a girlfriend and she said, imagine you cancel it and it's the real deal and it really changes your life. such as the USP of such experiences. So I went ahead with it. But so what I can say is that, you know, over the course of maybe it was 30, 35 minutes of, you know, very exertive breathing, which is distressful, that you do knock out parts of the cortex or whatever.
You're not so much conscious of your circumstances and whatever's on your mind.
And that itself opens up, I thought, something very fascinating, because it's this, the notion of who we think we are is not necessarily what everyone else is receiving. I've always come into conflict with that. And in my real life therapy, we're really working on trying to work out what happens, because I'm sending messages and they're being received very differently from the intention of my initial, you know, release.
Can you give me an example?
If we go way back to my hedge fund time, I remember having the head of our marketing, a lovely lady, for dinner. And maybe I was relaxing and I was trying to, and I was saying, you know what, you know, I look at the office, I think perhaps I must be, if not the most popular person, perhaps one of, I get down with the team, we talk about soccer, you know, I don't have any airs and graces. And it just caught her off guard. And I think she was drinking soup. It was one of those messy table encounters. She's like, oh my God, how can you be so deluded?
But was it deluded? Was it just something that someone typically wouldn't say? I mean, I can totally see how that would be true, that you would be sort of the life of the party in an office. It's hard to imagine you not being the life of the party anywhere you are, let alone a finance office.
Remember, at the same time, Denise, keep in mind that I have moments of great extrovertism, but I think actually in my life they're balanced out by very much the inverse of that, where I swallow up and I just can't bear to be out. I mean, you know, when I was young, I can recall going into Glasgow city centre with a mission to purchase some clothing or something, and getting to the shop front door and turning back. I could cross the threshold. I still don't fully understand what was so jarring. And I'd go home feeling a complete failure. So these are kind of the opposite. And I did read somewhere that actually the band separating introverted and extrovert is so tight that maybe you can, yeah, this oscillation naturally,
yeah,
that takes you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not so, if it's a label, if it's a classic label, I'm suspect. Because it's like, it's even how I ask you, you know, sort of what mood are you in these days? It's so context driven. I think it's interesting though. I still don't really know what's on your mind. Here we are on March 29th. You've been talking about things you've been doing. And it's, you know, do you feel good or bad, generally speaking, this week?
I don't feel great. I have some, I'm dealing with some uncertainties, some commercial uncertainties where I don't feel the same ability to address and to control them. I'm feeling perhaps that I'm actually, for the first time, vulnerable in some aspects of where I am. And I'm not enjoying that vulnerability.
I don't seem as lighthearted as normal. I know you're never really lighthearted, but you're often more, I don't know, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. You would know, it's French, isn't it? Soucian?
What do you want to say? Soucian.
S-O-U-S.
Yeah, I mean, soucian is a sort of,
you know, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Souci is to worry. So soucian would be someone gripped with.
So you are that backwards.
I am that, you know.
So exactly what is the worst case in each scenario? And in doing that, we'd get some gradation of reality to say you're concerned about some commercial aspects of your life. Is that, you know, can you put that a different way? Because I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yeah. So again, I do offer transparency, or I attempt to offer transparency with these things. You know, one of my, it was my, almost my sole commercial activity just now is, you know, leveraged real estate development. And I am very much a risk taker. And yeah, I really put everything out there to deliver this second house. And of course, it coincided with this awful pandemic, supply shortage, price inferno to the upside. And so budgeting, right, really got trashed. We've delivered something beautiful, but you know, at the expense of additional financial outlay. One isn't in control of these things, but then this hideous divorce thing came through, of course, just at peak vulnerability. And so that is occupying my mind, how I navigate those circumstances. So those circumstances would be just being on budgets and delivering and by the degree of compromise. So that's kind of it, takes away from the fun. But remember, typically we speak in I'm in St. Bart's. St. Bart's is, you know, again, like to use this word, fantasy, but it makes me feel 10 years younger. And for the last 6 weeks, I've been, I like this word, gallivanting, you know, but I've been having
fun. You have been gallivanting to the extent that I follow you on Instagram.
Yeah. What do you make of that? I mean, for those listening in, I try and commit to these stories. I like Instagram stories because they disappear. You know?
You and everybody else.
And also because they tell me that the blasted algo likes it, you know, is they like it for their platform.
Your daughters clearly adore you.
Oh, heavens. Yeah. It was my birthday on the 16th of March. And I find myself with new and wonderful friends, very creative, very large personalities. And we find ourselves at a table on my birthday. I think there were 12 or so people. Wonderful evening. And our family tradition has always been that we would construct poems in celebration. It's the best birthday present. You know, it's the manifestation.
Yeah. I was so impressed with her poem.
Wasn't it incredible? 15 and a half, again, surrounded with friends of her, new friends of her father. And I must add that my two daughters were there, and I didn't publish the other one, but you know, the both were impeccable and astonishing, and a great treat as a father to see. And to your point, the love was very evident. And
yeah. So you've done something right.
Yeah, I hope I've done many things right. I guess it's the receiving, the mapping, the recording of that. It's funny with so. Everyone's going
melancholy. Melancholy.
I do. Yeah. Well, I have to say that my ex, that was her principal charge sheet. I have to say that she would say to me, "You live the most perfect life. Why are you a miserable mother?"
I've heard that word a time.
Why are you melancholic? I think the answer to that actually was that I'd fallen out of love and I couldn't really deal with the consequences of that and the sense of failure that I associated with that. But that is not to deny a kind of that being a space perhaps that I seek out. So that said, but I'm sure I can give voice to everyone listening and they're saying, but yeah, tell us about the healer. What happened?
Yeah, that is an interesting story.
And it fits in with that because part of what he was pursuing was, if you will, ego and anti-ego. And this is almost like being right wing or left wing in this political theater. And as you get more and more grades of severity of it and you become, you know, very left, very right, you actually end up at the same spot, which is totalitarianism.
It has to be my way. Everybody has to adhere to my view of the world. So yes, those views of the world are different, but the same mechanisms.
And so I find myself, back when we did this initially, we had the other charge was the narcissism. I think you very kindly kind of pulled me away from that. You I think gave light to the notion of, you know, the true narcissist is intending pain on others. And I don't think you could see that in me. I don't want to put words in your mouth. But the healer could very much see this conflict within me where I'm successful and yet I can't deal with that. It's the one thing I can't accept. And so if you go, I've got this, and which creates this is the ego anti-ego. The ego is extrovert, successful, and the anti-ego is trying to draw it in, pull it in, control it. It's kind of attributing a lot of those characteristics negatively, but they end up taking you to the same place. Which seemed to be, he's like, for sure your ex-wife. Of course she thinks you're an ass. You end up being an ass. I don't know.
Does she still think that?
I don't know.
I'm really, yeah.
I don't know. I know there's still a lot of pain. But anyway, so after the tapping with the healer, I did space-time travel. I felt like it was a matrix escaping. What seemed to happen, Denise, was the mind had been shut. The control function of the mind that mind that kind of engages, like, this is who I am, this is the external world, and we have an interface. That was, and I think that's why I mentioned DMT. DMT is what is the chemical compound found in the ayahuasca and all of these, where people are seeking these kind of spiritual trips. There was no chemical compound. This was very, as I say, modest intervention.
Hi, this is a fake voice generated with AI. Those of you who are not patrons, your ride is over. To see the rest of this video, join the tribe and subscribe at patreon.com/hughhendry. Patrons, brace yourself and please keep your hands and feet in the vehicle at all times. Thank you, and now back to our normal programming.